Are you enjoying this podcast? Well, you have KUOW members to thank for that. KUOW members make the trusted local journalism and storytelling you hear on this show possible. Become a member today and help support the production of this podcast. It only takes a minute. Make a donation at KUOW.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thanks.
Welcome to Friday and welcome to Week in Review. I'm your host, Mike Lewis, in for Bill Radke, who is missing and presumed happy overseas. We have a terrific group of panelists today. Seattle Times transportation reporter David Croman. David, thank you for joining us.
Hi.
Freelance host, writer, and producer Angela Poe Russell, first time on the show. Nice to have you in.
It's so good to be here. Thank you.
And KUOW labor and economy reporter Monica Nicholsberg. Monica?
Great to be here.
Nice to see you. Thanks for joining us, all of you. You can also find the show streaming on YouTube and on Facebook. King County Metro last week reached a three-year contract with its drivers and mechanics that would raise salaries by a minimum of approximately 15%, which would eventually raise the starting salary from somewhere between $52,000 to $60,000 annually. That's good news for drivers and mechanics. And bringing us the bad news for King County Metro is Seattle Times' David Croman. other than salaries, what's the big issue Metro is trying to solve with this new contract, David?
Well, I mean, the first issue is that they don't have a contract.
Fair enough.
The last one expired in October, so they have to get a new one. But, you know, the timing of it is pretty good, I would say, for the union in particular, because the staffing issues at Metro are significant. And I think anybody who rides King County Metro buses right now will feel that. I mean, it's you kind of hear sometimes about staffing shortages in the abstract, but this is not abstract. I mean, it's impacting service.
Lines being canceled from time to time.
Yeah. So something like 40% of Metro's fleet is currently unavailable right now because of backlogs, maintenance backlogs, because they don't have enough mechanics and parts. And, you know, operators, there are not enough operators showing up to fill routes. And so, you know, as a result, King County Metro has needed to cancel something like 20 routes permanently, reduce another 12. And that's just to sort of reflect what people are already feeling on the ground. So the hope is that with this contract, you make King County Metro a more appealing place for people to come and work, and probably even more pressing in the short term to stay, because, you know, a lot of the workforce is still retirement age, and a lot of people could, you know, the pain might not be over just yet. I mean, there's still a lot of people who might be retiring. And so this contract offers incentives for people to stay and as well as for people to come on in the first place.
Monica, you mentioned before the show that even with the significant raise, some drivers remain dissatisfied with the contract. Why is that?
Yeah, it seems like one of the key sticking points for these drivers and across the labor force more broadly is a lack of control over their schedules. That's something that we see come up a lot in contract negotiations. It's a big issue for the unions that are forming at Starbucks, is folks want to feel like they have a little bit more control over their time. And especially in a labor force like this, where there are shortages and people have a lot of options, it can be a place where they really, you know, organize around and try to form some worker power to have a little bit more control.
When they, David, let me throw something back to you, because you mentioned something in passing about routes being canceled. Tell me a little bit about that, because what my experience has been is that frequently it tends to be the semi-low usage routes, but the people who depend probably the most on the bus. Is that the case?
I think, yeah, that's right. I mean, if you ride the higher frequency routes, like, you know, say the 8 or something that goes by Amazon, you're probably starting to experience really late arriving buses because of traffic and things like that, but they are showing up eventually. But you're right, on some of the sort of lower use routes, you know, there's a certain amount of triage that King County Metro has to do, so they look to the routes that maybe don't get as much use, and that's where there tends to be scaling back. You know, the interesting thing about their adjustments is it's, you know, they don't love the word cancel, because in some ways those routes are already being canceled in a de facto way,
right?
Just because they're never showing up, and, you know, they wake up in the morning, they look at what's available, and they say, you know what, we can't run this anymore. So what they're saying is these schedule changes are actually just reflecting what's already happening and what people are already experiencing. It's sort of similar to what the state ferries did, which is to say, look, we're going to put out a schedule out there that's reduced, but the hope is that by doing so, at least, you know, you know, if the 10 o'clock is on the schedule, the 10 o'clock is actually
going to
show
up. If it's actually going to show, right, yeah. Right.
Here's a question I have. I mean, obviously, being able to keep the people engaged who are at that retirement age, you know, staying in place so you don't lose any more people. So, yes, the raises are a big piece of this. But how much of the problem, what was that figure you threw out, like 40% of the fleet? I mean, it's almost half.
Yeah.
How much of this is also... Are there people out there who can do the job? I mean, in terms of some of this mechanical stuff, being able to maintain the fleet, how much of that is the problem versus just the money?
No, it's a really good question. It's a huge part of the problem, actually. And, I think any kind of trade career these days is going to run into this problem, in part because for decades now we've emphasized going to college and getting a bachelor's degree and have de-emphasized trades. And so there is just sort of an industry. More than industry, just sort of a global shortage of mechanics and, welders or electricians, plumbers whatever the it works, might be. Right. And so that's – Metro is certainly feeling that. There's this sort of added wrinkle of most of Metro's buses at this point are hybrid electric. And the parts that go into hybrid electric are a lot more advanced than your sort of old traditional diesel diesel buses. And so as a result – Metro is actually competing with, you know, the aeronautic industry, like pretty high-tech, advanced mechanical stuff. And so it's, they're just in this sort of terrible position right now where there's global shortage of mechanics generally, but also, you know, people have decent offers to go, you know, up to Everett, maybe work for Boeing.
Right. And Angela, let me ask you a question, because you mentioned something before the show about... This is not the whole theme of this show should probably be staffing issues, because it seems like in every topic we're going to be discussing today, there is a staffing issue component. You mentioned that specifically because we're not just talking about King County Metro. We're talking about public institutions all over.
Yes. So many of us have experienced this, right, where you lose power and you see the crews come out and they're the unsung heroes. And I had a chance to go out and just talk to some of the members of the crew. And one of them was going on 24 hours straight working, another one 30 hours. And I was like, what's the problem? And he's like, oh, people don't want to do this job. We just don't have enough linemen. And so, yeah, similar story. How do you get these people? But then as I bring up the number of people we have available to do the job, on the other hand, I just talked to a guy yesterday who had been in treatment for drugs. And he said, when people come out of treatment, like, they need work, they need stuff to kind of. So I'm hearing on one hand, people are needing work, right, and maybe they don't have the skill set. So it makes me wonder, do we have, what programs are out there to match these opportunities with folks who said, hey, I need a shot?
You know, I love if we make this a staffing show because I'm the labor reporter.
Oh, yep.
I'm actually working on a story right now about why it's so hard to hire a plumber, why there are these shortages in the trades that predate COVID. And one of the obstacles that I've encountered in my reporting is that a lot of them drug test and cannabis counts. And that is a barrier for folks.
They're counting cannabis?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, while
and I'm not judging any of it either way, but right. I'm just saying at the stage where we're dealing with some of the major issues, transportation, all the things, is that something that's wise to leave out? But go on. I just wanted to clarify.
No. I mean, it's a good question. It's one piece of the puzzle. There are a lot of factors at play here. I think, like David mentioned, we decided that all kids need to get a 4-year degree at a university and sort of stopped doing as much of the vocational training that they need in schools and the education just more broadly, that you can go into these fields and make six figures. They're good jobs if you're willing to work hard. English language is another barrier. And I think there is this renewed interest in apprenticeships, in connecting people with good jobs, but it's going to take time to rebuild those pipelines.
Absolutely. And not to move the subject, but we're going to another sort of staffing area, which is SPD, but specific. And Monica, you're going to be good to talk to about this because you've actually covered the tech world for a long period of time and now here at KUOW. But there was a street racing incident. Everyone probably knows about this already in Capitol Hill in the early morning hours last Sunday. It led to a really rowdy crowd and eventually gunfire that left 4 people shot, 1 fatally. In response, the Seattle Department of Transportation has begun an analysis focused on whether or not traffic cameras could help curb the street racing problem. And City Council member Alex Peterson, council members Alex Peterson and Lisa Herbold have both introduced legislation that would seek to add traffic cameras to 10 sort of restricted racing zones, oddly named restricted racing zones because they're not actually to be restricted away from racing. It's somewhat like the enhanced penalties that come with near school drug-free zones, as well as automated traffic penalties such as red light cameras. Monica, let me ask you then, as we turn to bots and AI for law enforcement, what are the broader implications here?
Softball. Well, you know, any time that you're going to bring in a surveillance technology, I think you just need to be really intentional about what the trade-offs are. They're not always necessarily bad. Like, I think anybody who's driven through a school zone that's photo enforced realizes that their photo's being taken. Those tickets are very expensive. We're trading a little bit of privacy in the public sphere for kids' safety, which a lot of people would say that's worth that trade-off. I think in this situation, you know, I don't know enough about it to say whether it's a good trade-off. I think there are, you know, one question I had was like, maybe communities of color would prefer this because it leads to fewer interactions with cops. You know, the technology is more neutral. But you mentioned AI, and we all know that technology is not neutral. And
not
so what other concerns are there going to be around profiling and around the data that's fed into these technologies? They're big, big picture questions. We'd probably have to get a law enforcement reporter in here to answer some of them. But I think that they need to be very much part of the discussion from the beginning.
You go right into the question I had for Angela. Angela, you mentioned that cameras should come equipped with a, quote, equity lens.
Let me just clarify.
Yeah.
It was someone, I'm trying to recall where that quote came from.
Which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, I actually rolled my eyes at it. So basically, there was this proposal out there. So correct me if I'm wrong, any of you on the beat. But this proposal came out and then they said, oh, before we make it final, we need to put it through the equity lens. So I'm just curious, like, what that means. Does an equity lens mean on where we're placing them? I want to know what that means, because I don't want it to mean this is delayed for several more months because we need to talk about it. That's right. My only concern. You know, I always hear people saying, well, we don't want to militarize certain Black communities. You know, people, I hesitate because I live in the CD. And it's like, is it a Black community? You know, it's with all the gentrification. I'm like, I don't know if that's there. You know, at the end of the day, I think I didn't grow up with cops meaning military and it's a threat. My dad was a police officer and he believed in community policing. So we knew, like, even when I lived in Burien, like, we knew the officers, we engaged with them. It was a relationship.
Right.
My dad bragged about having a beat and knowing the people, knowing the players, knowing the problems. And obviously we're dealing with a staff shortage, but it's just my sense, like, if we just had beat officers the way we used to, like, you probably would prevent a lot of the issues and these street racing things building because you have people there. So
let's go back then to the, since this is the official, now we've decided the official staffing show. David, is there enough police available to do, like, beat form the way we used to do beat patrols? Or what do you think the police officers union would say about that?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'll pivot just slightly, which is, you know, if we're going to make it about staffing, you know, when you look at Seattle Police Department's traffic records, you know, they haven't written basically a traffic ticket in 3 years. You know, the Seattle Police Department basically does not do traffic enforcement anymore, nor does the Washington State Patrol. I mean, they do. Washington State Patrol does, but, you know, their traffic,
I'm
number of tickets or infractions.
When I see someone pulled over in Seattle, and I can't remember the last time I have pulled over for what appears to be a traffic violation.
Yeah.
It's like you said. I mean, it's incredibly unusual anymore.
It's very
I got
rare.
Pulled over on Mercer Island.
Right,
probably
yeah.
Not as unusual.
But you know, I mean, I think I suppose maybe the Seattle Police Department could do beat cops, but it would be, you know, what they would say, I imagine, is that means taking police away from usually specialty units. You know,
right.
There was actually reporting that combination of KUW and Seattle Times. Was probably about a year ago at this point, about the sexual assault unit, and that was basically stripped bare, and that there wasn't really anybody investigating sexual assaults anymore. And, you know, part of that is the Seattle Police Department saying, well, we wanted to put these people on patrol.
Right.
And so that's kind of where we're at right now. And so, you know, traffic enforcement was one of the early casualties of that. You know, I think the DUI unit has since been put together, but for a while there, they had disbanded their DUI unit. They weren't going after DUIs. And so, you know, I think that there's a correlation there between why suddenly automated enforcement like this and traffic cameras is getting a lot more interest, both at the state and city level, because there's some hope that, you know, you remove that kind of person-to-person interaction where, you know, a gun can get pulled and something goes wrong.
Right.
And also you're, you know, taking care of an enforcement action at a time when a lot more people are dying on the roads without needing to add new staff. All you need to do is put up more cameras.
But what does an equity lens mean in the context of the cameras? Like, to me, it seems like, you know, you would put the cameras where you've had street racing. And so, I mean, does anyone know? That's the thing I want to know.
Well, I mean, you know, there's some of the most dangerous streets in Seattle run through neighborhoods that are less white and less rich. And there's a lot of reasons for that. Decades of zoning. You know, it's easier to put big roads through communities that maybe don't have as strong of a voice or as much time to spend.
Less policing sometimes in those.
Less policing. Yeah. And so, you know, I think if you really kind of start to unpack it, you can say, you know, why is Rainier Avenue, for example, such an unsafe street? It really is. You know, a lot of people would say it's not a coincidence that it runs through, you know, a lot of non-white communities. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, if you're starting to put cameras on the most dangerous streets that are in sort of black and brown communities, you're going to catch more, you know, you're going to enforce against more non-white people, and therefore there are equity concerns.
Were you going to say something? I saw you nodding.
I was going to say the same thing, just if you think about the downstream effects of, we want to try to reduce this one thing, illegal racing, which we all saw tragically last weekend, what can happen. That, you know, that's a noble intention, but then you've got cameras in these communities of color, and then what happens if they catch other sort of low-level crimes, and then do those crimes get pursued at a higher rate than crimes in white neighborhoods that might also be happening but aren't getting the same attention, something like that.
Right, I think that's definitely a concern that's been stated. We will be right back. We've got to take a brief break. We'll be back with Week in Review in just a minute or two.
This podcast is free, and it's accessible to everyone thanks to support from listeners like you. If you value this show, please consider supporting its production by donating to our home, KUOW. It only takes a minute to give, and you'll be helping to support the production of this podcast. Make a donation at KUOW.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thanks!
Welcome back to Week in Review. We are joined by Seattle Times transportation reporter David Croman, KUOW labor and economy reporter Monica Nicholsberg, host, writer, and producer Angela Poe Russell. Welcome, all of you. The Seattle City Council has seven seats up for grabs in the upcoming election. And while every city council is literally a referendum on city government, this one feels like a potential sea change. Monica, we're going to start with you. You've certainly spent some time covering the city council the past few years, particularly its dust-ups with Amazon and payroll taxes. How do you see the broad choices for voters at this particular point with this upcoming election?
Well, I think no matter what, there's going to be change. There are a lot of seats up for grabs, like you said, and I think it's an opportunity for voters to really set the direction that the council's going to go in. It can be hard to differentiate between candidates in Seattle because pretty much everyone is going to, you know, say that they're a Democrat and ostensibly seem like they're in the same place on issues. But if you do a little research, particularly I would recommend reading the Seattle Times and The Stranger, you can start to see some of the nuances. And often they tend to sort into sort of a more very left, kind of very progressive side, or a more business-oriented public safety side, I would say. I mean, that's oversimplifying it. But I think that those tend to be kind of the issues, especially in this election.
And Angela, question for you then. Much of the discussion about Seattle and the role of government focuses on affordability issues such as housing, utilities, food. What role, if any, should a city council take to make a city more affordable?
It has a major role to play, and I guess I should throw my name in the ring for this. Oh, I think it has a major role to play. I mean, there are so many things. I mean, when you look at policy that impact how expensive something is. And for example, let's talk about the resistance by so many communities to allow denser housing. Or has, is that the right word, the right way to put it? But basically, you know, wanting to keep our single family home development. And, you know, we had the policy against what the big massive houses, what did they call it? The super houses.
McMansions.
McMansions. And so I say all this to say that, yes, the city council absolutely plays a role in that. Because it's my belief that when you have a problem finding a place to rent because either it's too expensive or there aren't enough units available, that drives up the price, period. Right. So how do we increase what's out there so we're not, you know, so you kind of bring down that demand a little bit? And there are so many things we can do. I mean, right now, we've had the discussion of design review. It takes too long. I think it's extreme to sit there and say, okay, we just don't have design review. No one's saying that. Just do the job in a more efficient way. If you need to hire more people, do that. Right now, these poor small businesses, I've talked to many who they can't get a permit. I just saw someone on social media last week. Hey, I'm trying to get my business open. Could use a permit. You know, can we? I think doing some of the basic things well, putting policies in place that help us operate more efficiently. I know it's sounds so cliche to say, but it's so true. Like, we need to do the basic things well so that we aren't all scrambling for the same thing and driving up the prices.
That makes complete sense. So, David, turning to you, since you're an expert on these things, we're hoping to get a detailed analysis of all 45 council candidates for this special 8-hour edition of Week in Review. The council and mayoral elections in recent history have played out as a lot of what Monica said, with this backdrop of Amazon and the Chamber of Commerce. Mm-hmm. How is this election the same, or how is it different?
Yeah, it's different because I would say that their place in this election, at least from my standpoint, it seems like it's less than it used to be. And I think that's intentional because, you know, the last time this many council seats were up, Amazon went really hard and the Chamber of Commerce went really hard and really late to try and flip the council towards a slate that would be more favorable to them and, you know, frankly, probably less favorable to some kind of payroll tax. You know, that is widely seen as kind of a disaster because suddenly it took an unpopular council and made the question, do you side with the council or do you side with Amazon, this sort of big business? And when they made it about themselves, suddenly people started voting more progressive.
You just took me back to a very triggering point in history, yeah. Because I remember watching that in real time and thinking, as much as I hate what some of these politicians are doing, brilliant, like brilliant move, because you just pitted these two important entities in our community against each other and saying, how can we work with each other?
Yeah, totally. And I think that the chamber did a lot of reflection and dissolved their PAC after that election. So the case political action committee is basically nowhere to be found in this election.
The chamber won to a small degree by getting Bruce Harrell as mayor, correct?
Yeah, and they also didn't do that much publicly and found out that Bruce, they kind of stood back and turned out that what Bruce Harrell was saying was much more popular among voters. So my sense is that they're sort of, you know, they see this election, this would be my guess, sort of going in a certain direction and say, you know, we're not going to get in the way of that if that's where it's actually going.
That makes sense.
To Angela's point, I think about she's talking about density, and that's really interesting to me about this election is, you know, you think back to 2015 or 2017 even, and there was not that level of unanimity around needing to increase housing stock and needing to add more density in the city. You know, the Seattle Times reporters did a kind of survey of candidates, and it's basically across the board, everyone saying we need to add density to increase the housing stock. And that, to me,
You mean the whole paradigm shifted?
Yeah, the paradigm has shifted quite a bit. There's just not the same level of disagreement around making changes to single family zoning and adding more rental units. And I think that just kind of highlights how dire and desperate people have started to feel about the housing crisis.
The question is, they keep talking, we need affordable. What does affordable mean right now? Mm-hmm. Like, is that $1 million? Is it?
Right.
You know, when they talk, but I do think that just being able to increase the supply, and I'm sure there's some economists that would have a nice debate with me about all this, but it just seems to make a lot of sense for me as a consumer.
Monica, the affordability issue obviously is a big one. Renting, owning, if you can even get into the category of owning in Seattle. those are big issues. Outside of that, what do you see as the city council issues that are less related specific to Seattle's affordability, or is that one such a gravity center that really it matters more than anything?
Housing and homelessness are the biggest issues, I think. I don't think anybody would debate that. That's what comes up the most when you're talking with folks. But I also think that the public safety conversation is a big one. You know, there are a lot of small business owners running for council, and I was just chatting with our food reporter.
Noticing that as well, right?
Yeah, Ruby DeLuna, our food reporter, and I were talking about it, and you know, she brought up a great point that there's this sort of spirit among especially like small restaurant owners of like, you know, when you're short staffed, when there's a problem, roll up your sleeves and try to fix it yourself. And I think a number of businesses, especially downtown, are feeling the pain of these concurrent crises that we haven't been able to solve as a city, you know, the housing crisis, the opioid epidemic, the fraying relationship between the police and the community, which I think we're going to talk about a little bit more later. So I think that those things are also really front of mind. And one other thing I'd add quickly is that even though Amazon is not on the ballot in the way that it was last time, they still have a presence for sure. They're an employee that they fired, Maren Costa, is running in District 1. She is a tech worker activist who is now kind of using her, you know, she claims that she was able to successfully pressure Amazon to step up on climate change and that she could do something similar at city council. And Amazon actually cannot donate anymore, apparently. I was just talking with them about this because of the Clean Campaigns Act.
Right, right.
I forgot about that.
So I don't know that they would anyway after last time. But
talk about the Clean Campaigns Act.
So, okay, I as far as I understand it, it forbids entities with even a small percentage of foreign ownership from donating in local elections. Oh. David, is that your understanding?
Yeah, I think that's the gist. Okay. It's been a while since I've thought about it. I'm just remembering that even exists.
So let me ask you this. Do you feel like the relationship between Amazon and the city council has improved in the last several years? Because it was really – I was seeing it play out as a resident of the city of Seattle – and feeling like this is not what I want. Like, I need my government, and I also need companies like Amazon and Microsoft. They matter. And it was like everyone was fighting with each other. Has it smoothed out a bit, in your view?
I don't know if it's smoothed out. I mean, it was at such a bad place, I agree, that it's hard to imagine it going anywhere but up. that being said, I think it's become less in the public sphere. Mm. You know, those conversations, I think, are happening more privately after learning some lessons of the big battles between the city and Amazon. And I think it will continue to trend in that direction because it just hasn't been a winning strategy for them to fight Seattle's government out in the open.
Well, it was kind of a win with the transportation thing, right? About Sound Transit in terms of Amazon kind of voicing some concerns and the government kind of saying, "Hey, we agree," and finding. Well, am I getting that wrong?
No. I think that there's that is absolutely. I mean, it's not like Amazon's influence has gone away. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that just the upfront combative nature. I mean, remember Amazon did everything Amazon remapped downtown Seattle relatively quietly, not from a construction and disruption standpoint, but its efforts were not as public as it became during the payroll tax. That's when Amazon sort of like showed at least one facet of itself. And to your point, I don't see that Amazon is not going to have a whole bunch of wins in the future. I mean, I imagine Amazon probably will, but maybe the fights won't be, they'll be there, but maybe not as loud this time.
I just want us to work together. Like if I were a city official and all the resources that we have in the Pacific Northwest, I would be trying to figure out how we all work together. How can I tap into your resources? How do we, it just felt like it was a waste of energy and opportunity to fight.
No, absolutely. All right. Switching quickly, one more state-level issue before we go on break. A referendum to overturn state law that would extend runaway shelter protections for trans teens last week failed to get enough signatures to get on the ballot. The proposed ballot measure, which was famously backed by Donald Trump Jr., would have rolled back protections approved by the state that extended existing shelter protections offered to runaway teens to include trans teens seeking an abortion or teens seeking an abortion or gender-affirming care. As they have been in the past, shelters are required to inform the State Department of Children and Youth Families about the child so the department can begin reunification. David, First question for you, what are the differences between the new state law protecting trans runaways and other teens who ran away from home for different reasons, such as physical abuse?
I don't know if I know the exact differences there. I just my understanding, though, is
was on the notification end of things. Correct?
Yeah, right. So my understanding is, there's a tough balance, of course, in the shelter system of wanting to sort of account for young people, but then also, you know, some of those young people are running away right. from abusive parents, and so notifying the parents of these young people being in a shelter, obviously that's not a good thing. And so they instead go to the state, they go to DSHS. Right. This would have sort of just expanded that the parameters that shelters have to follow to kids who are maybe seeking gender affirming care or an abortion. And, you know, it in some ways, I think it got a little blown out of proportion what it exactly meant, because it was framed as the state stealing your kids.
And all they're saying is, just so we're clear, they would contact Department of Youth and Families.
Right.
Yeah, and then they would be the ones to kind of work on getting the parents
some
involved.
Level of reunification.
Yes. So, you know, I mean, it's got basically the perfect perfect ingredients for a cultural storm, because right. you're talking about parental rights, transgender young people, many of whom are under 18.
You know, if you even bring up transgender young people, I mean, it's immediately becomes this cultural flashpoint, right?
Exactly. And, you know, I don't know how often this scenario has or will come up. You know, I will say, though, that, you know, a disproportionate number of young people who are in the shelter system are LGBTQ. And so, right. And, you know, that's not a coincidence, because
it's not a coincidence.
Of course, we know that a lot of people aren't accepted at home for, you know, their sexual identity. And so they end up running away. Or being kicked out.
Yeah, if you aren't going to conform to being straight or whatever it is the parents want them to be, then get out of my house.
Exactly. And so this the intention behind this was to sort of extend protections to people who might find themselves in really precarious, dangerous situations. You know, like every law that's passed, I'll be very curious to see how it actually plays out and how often this actually comes up. Because this referendum failed, in part because the Catholic Church initially said that they wouldn't help signature gatherers get out there and collect signatures. They decided sort of at the last minute that they actually were going to help people collect signatures.
I was so disappointed by that.
And then it still came up 5,000 short. So as for now, this is law.
Which, as a percentage, though, isn't very far from actually getting on the ballot. I mean,
given that
it's 162,000 signatures.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think they ever actually turned in the signatures. So 5,000 short may have ended up being quite a few more than 5,000 short.
Because they all have to be verified, right?
Yeah. And, you know, there's some, I don't know what the percentage is, but some percentage of every initiative when they're turned in, a lot of the signatures end up being repeats or.
Right.
And so, you know, signature gatherers, they try to get many thousands of signatures more than what they require. So I think they probably still had more to go than just 5,000 signatures. But you have to imagine if the Catholic Church had maybe gotten involved earlier, then yeah, this could have been on the ballot.
Monica, talk for a second. We're going to get to a break pretty quick here, but I wanted to hear from you about this tension between what these shelters have to report and what parents expect to happen. If someone finds your kid, I mean, you want to know immediately, but the shelters are they're caught in this tension mm-hmm. between, you know, a perception of protecting the kids and a perception of what they were leaving in the household. I mean, do you think that these reporting restrictions actually help keep kids off the street?
I do. I think it's important to be clear that there is no part of this that involves keeping children away from their parents for any long amount of time. The function of it is to keep the kids in the shelter and not have them bolt because they're afraid, because their parents have just been called and they're aware of that. So it brings in counselors, it brings in some extra services so that when they are reconnected with their parents, there hopefully are supports there to facilitate that process in a way that's safe for the children. And also it just keeps them in the system rather than having them run and then potentially end up on the streets. I think that has gotten completely lost in the debate over this,
right.
which is much more centered in fear, because any parent would be afraid of their child being taken from them or receiving medical care without them being involved. But that's just not what's happening.
Okay, we will be right back with Week in Review after a short break. Welcome back to Week in Review. We are joined by KUOW economy and labor reporter Monica Nicholsberg, Seattle Times transportation reporter David Croman, host, writer, and producer Angela Poe Russell. Let's get right into it as we wrap up the show. Last weekend was one of the busiest in Seattle. I read by one estimate, was one of the most densely populated places in the western United States during last weekend. We had, of course, Taylor Swift, you may have heard of her, Capitol Hill Block Party, Bite of Seattle, Mariners, just terrific weather, which added to the whole mix, the works. But there was one critical development that has been reported on since then as a reaction to, and it was a lack of sufficient police presence. David, let's start with you. What happened?
Well, that's what's interesting about it is we're not entirely sure. The union president, Mike Solon, came out and said that something like 50% of officers called out sick, suggesting that it was a sick out.
Said what?
But then he said that as union president, he would not have explicitly condoned that. And in fact, told union officers that such a labor action for a police union would be illegal. And so it's just this kind of awkward thing where, when unions take action, the whole point is to be really noticed because you're trying to make a statement. You're trying to be disruptive and you want as many people to notice that as possible. When you get into kind of public safety unions like this, labor actions end up being a little more subtle. And in this case, we have not heard sort of 100%, at least not that I've read, have not seen 100% confirmation that this was in fact a sick out. It's also summer. A lot of people go on vacation and things like that. So, I don't know. It's kind of, I'm interested to hear Monica's labor take on this. Interesting thing.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. I think that being united is what really leads to worker power when you're going to have an action. From some of the reporting I saw, it seemed like there were definitely folks who were saying that's what was going on. We are understaffed, under-resourced. We're tired of this, and we want to make that known. But it seems like there may not have been a unified front on that.
Right.
Angela, let me ask you then, how do we get, of all the issues we've run across so far, and I don't know that anything from a staffing level has been talked about more than one-third shortage on police officers in Seattle, something along those lines. How do we get more police officers in Seattle?
We have to change our rhetoric. That's a big part of it. I mean, we can talk about the money and the bonuses. Yes, that's important. It has to be there. We also have to adjust the rhetoric. And it doesn't mean that we don't hold people accountable who do things that are wrong. Absolutely, we need to hold people accountable. But at the end of the day, law enforcement, like, they're part of our community. They're public servants at their best, and we need them. I mean, it's a relationship thing. And I was talking about this week that when the Pride Parade happened, and it was like, okay, law enforcement can't be part of that. I mean, those kind of things just create this. I think, Monica, you put it well in something you said earlier, that right now the relationship is just, it's really difficult. I also think when I look at this latest action, which, yes, it appears to have been a sick out. We can't say that officially, but 50% calling in is pretty significant. We have to think about leadership. Do we have the right, if something, and you tell me, Monica, but if something gets to a point where workers feel like we have to call out, I don't know. I'm a big believer as leaders, you have to take responsibility. And so I put this at the feet of the chief and I don't know Chief Diaz well, but I always respect when a person at the top says, when this happens, I need to own it, that for whatever reason, they felt like that was their only option.
I think it's a really difficult situation, kind of unlike any other. We're seeing labor unrest in a lot of different mm-hmm. industries, but I think the police and the police in Seattle is really unique because we didn't get to this point on accident. There was a long documented track record of the police behaving in a way where they lost the trust of the community. Mm-hmm. And then we had the Seattle City Council in response to that talking about defunding the police. And then we had the relationship fray even further. And then there's mistrust between city government and the police. And I totally hear you about taking accountability and about leadership stepping up. But at the same time, I wouldn't want that job right now because honestly, I don't know what the path forward is.
Yeah, that's a great question. And it seems to me like when we're talking about SPD and we're talking about labor shortages, we also have to talk about sort of the broader issue in that how many large American cities aren't experiencing this, regardless of, you know, whether it's a progressive or a conservative city council. Every single major department seems to be, I mean, let me ask anyone in the group who cares to answer this. It feels to me, and as the daughter of a police officer, it feels to me like there's this larger malaise regarding policing in America right now, and not just specific to Seattle.
That is very true. And, you know, these days we're seeing what's been happening all along through our, you know, mobile phones. And it's like each week I see, because just at that point where I think, you know, things are turning, people are getting the message, maybe the bad officers are quitting, then you see another incident and you're just like, really? Like, why is this okay? Why hasn't this person who's part of law enforcement been arrested? I do think if we start quickly holding officers who make mistakes accountable, I shouldn't make mistakes. There's making a mistake and then there's actually willfully just doing something that's awful. And when they quickly hold them accountable, that will build community trust. And on the other hand, I think that police need to hear from the community that they're supported. So yeah, this is a nationwide problem, I think largely driven by what we're seeing, the actual videos, and then also by the fact that they aren't often being held accountable in an expeditious way.
Monica, talk for a second about, or maybe more than one, about the difference between, I mean, we frequently talk with, and especially if it's a Seattle Police Department issue, the union president, Mike Solon, is always the person who is the spokesperson for this. But police unions are different than a regular labor union in a lot of very key ways. And you brought it up, David, about that you can't legally even have a sick out. It has to be this unofficial thing, probably shared through, I don't know, WhatsApp or Facebook groups or something like that to actually get people doing this, because as a union president, he obviously can't say it, but he can say it without saying it. And I think that that's potentially what was demonstrated last. When we talk about public employees unions, and we're also talking about, you know, other unions, obviously Seattle's always been a fairly friendly union town. The distinctions between a SPOG, which is Seattle Police Officers Guild, and other unions are pretty clear, but I'm not sure that people always understand that. I mean, they actually have stricter guidelines on what they can and can't do as far as labor protests than other unions, correct?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, and when you see that here in a place like Seattle, and you see that there that this is a potential sick out, I mean, is it possible that they don't have other recourses? I mean, this is really, I mean, they can't really go on strike, right? So how do they then enact some form of a protest saying we deserve better treatment as union members?
I remember I was in Montreal, actually, in like 2011, I want to say, and there was some action like this going on, and all the police officers were not wearing like their standard uniforms. That was their protest. They
really?
Couldn't quit. They couldn't walk off the job.
Right.
Obviously, Canada has different labor laws than the United States, but similar in that they're not allowed to go on strike. And so you walked around, you'd see all of these officers wearing like basically street clothes, even though they were in marked cars and things like that. And so you see little things like that. You know, the labor and police union relation to me is kind of endlessly fascinating. Around 2020. MLK Labor Council, basically
right.
the union of unions in King County, voted to kick SPOG out of that body. You know, there was a lot of argument at the time about how, in fact, police unions are different than regular unions. But that wasn't unanimous. You know, the Richard Trumka at the top of the AFL-CIO, he stood by police unions. And so that to me is just one of those really interesting debates about where police unions fit into the broader union landscape.
And is anyone, Monica or you, David, or anyone paying attention to this, is there any warming of the relationship? Chief Diaz was supposed to be a person who could maybe make this a little bit more collegial, you know, push hard to get more officers hired. Is anyone seeing anything in this regard, or that they're catching up to the deficit in officers?
I don't think they are catching up to the deficit. And you know, you talked about changing rhetoric. We were talking about the city council. I was just looking at actually a KUW story by David Hyde, pointing out that, you know, Dan Strauss, who in 2020 was one of the people who, you know, if not explicitly calling for defund the police, it signaled a willingness to talk about defunding the police.
Andrew Lewis as well.
And Andrew Lewis. And he put out a flyer for his reelection this year that says on it, defund the police was a mistake. That was one of the
that's a significant.
And so that, you know, we, Bruce Harrell was the I don't support defund the police guy in the mayor races, and he won by 20 points. You know, it's so the rhetoric has changed. You know, the money is there. There is budget to hire people. But I think, you know, it's a question of there is sort of a basic kind of cultural disconnect, I think, between some of the Seattle police officers and the city of Seattle. We saw that a few weeks ago when body camera footage came out and there was a big Trump flag in one of the break rooms in Seattle Police Department.
What a break of trust. When you talk about that relationship with the community and the police being rebuilt, and then all of a sudden that comes out, and the fact that it had been there for a while.
Yeah.
So people just put up with it and let it stay there.
Yeah.
And I think that is why police sort of stand aside in the larger labor story that we've been tracking, where sympathy for unions and support for labor is really high right now. But I don't think when people are thinking about supporting the average worker that they're including the police union there. I think it's a different story.
Exactly. All right. If I could, I'm going to move it on to one final topic before we get into our smile of the week. Amazon, which has remapped downtown Seattle more than any other force in recent years, has come out against light rail, specific light rail expansion to add a stop in South Lake Union. Monica, what's going on here?
Yeah, it's a little bit more nuanced than that. But basically, there was an original plan for the expansion of the light rail to get the light rail over to Ballard that would involve closing Westlake Avenue for at least 4 years while that station was under construction. And this week, Amazon came out and said that they supported a plan that would shift that station west. Problem is, Sound Transit initially said that in order to do that, they would have to close the planned South Lake Union station and consolidate the two. And transit advocates, that was like a non-starter for them. So what they voted on this week was to consider a different proposal to move the station north and also potentially study the shifted west option, but only if they can keep South Lake Union open.
So what would we be ending up with then? We'd still end up with a station in South Lake Union, correct or no?
Yes, I think everybody pretty much agreed that was an outcome of the meeting, was that they were not looking at closing the South Lake Union station.
And go ahead, Andrew.
No, I just was everybody happy now? I'm trying to.
No. No one is happy.
No. We can't move on. Darn it. Okay.
I mean, this is what happens when. This is what happens when you do two things. First, you try to build a mass transit system in a city that already is fairly well built up. There is basically no we have seen this at almost literally almost every single stop in this planning between West Seattle and Ballard. There has been some fight over disruptions that it's going to cause. It's going to cause disruptions. It's going to be a pain for people. That is just going to be the reality of building a mass transit system through a built out city. You know, the other thing is we voted on a package that was flexible. So when voters approved Sound Transit 3, it didn't bind the Sound Transit board to the options that were contained in there. And what that means is that you have, you know, we are 6 years removed from Sound Transit 3 being built, and we are still reconsidering where to put stations. And
which,
you know,
is why it's taken us so long to get here.
There's some nuance to why, you know, it's a really expensive thing and you have to collect tax revenue and all that. But it just opens up a big political can of worms when, rather than voting on a pre-baked package with this is where things are definitely going, you vote on a concept which is to expand light rail that is flexible, you get these fights that, you know, the Sound Transit Board has had consultants come on and say, you guys got to stop this. You guys have to move forward.
But here's why I think it was wise. I can see the wisdom in it, because when we voted on that, could we have predicted a pandemic that really brought small businesses to their knees? And so for me, when I think about being thoughtful about this, it's not just about, well, I'm being inconvenienced because of traffic and the roads and all that. But these businesses are just trying to stay alive. And I do think if there's a way to minimize the impact so that they can make it through this next thing, it's like, don't give them a pandemic and then shut everything down around them. That's so I see your point, like just vote on the plan and move forward. But having that flexibility, especially when you can't, you know, even imagine what might change. I can see that too.
Right. All right, we're going to that's almost a show, but we're going to get into, I think, Bill's favorite segment, which is something this week that made you smile. Angela, let's start with you.
Oh, it was the U.S. Women's National Team playing against the Netherlands. Oh, my goodness. What a game.
Good game.
It was
game.
It was just rough and tumble, gritty. Just it was awesome. It was fun to watch.
David?
Well, we've talked so much about labor on this show. Thing that made me smile is the Seattle Times Union has a tentative agreement.
Hey, oh, congratulations. Awesome. I didn't know.
Yeah, as of they announced it like right before I came on the show.
Wow.
So that's we've been in negotiations for a long time. Our contract expired months
Having
ago.
Having been involved in those negotiations when I was a post-intelligence reporter, I know how difficult that is. Congratulations.
Yeah, no thanks to me. I was not at the bargaining table. Thanks to the bargaining team. But yeah, it's a good thing.
I'm smiling because it's Banty Friday at KUOW.
I didn't know you did this. I was talking to Kevin before the show, producer Kevin Kniestad.
I think it's new. And our producer, Kevin Kniestad, is wearing a shirt. I'm looking at him right now that says, I heart Jewel. It's iconic. That is making me smile.
It's a what Friday? What did you call it?
Banty Friday.
Oh, and what is yours?
Mine is Lou Reed.
Oh, Lou Reed. Nice.
I could not get tickets to Taylor. I tried until the very last minute
last weekend.
And I was bummed. So
you
now it's like I could
or
not.
You weren't willing to take out a mortgage to do it.
Okay, good question. I was not willing to trade my firstborn child. and I was bummed. So I've just totally flipped the script. I'm only listening to the retro music from high school that I was into. And Taylor is on hiatus in my house.
You see how that is a more empowering thing, right? You chose not to.
Yes, exactly.
Yes. Exactly. We'll go with that.
And I'll give one quick shout out. My smile for the week is all of you folks who rode in the Ramrod, which I did as well yesterday, which is a ridiculously hard bicycle ride around Mount Rainier. Congratulations if you got all the way through it. Congratulations if you just tried. That's why I'm feeling a little bit sort of strung out today. I'm still a little bit exhausted because I'm just way too old to be doing this anymore. Anyway, that makes it for a show. Thanks for joining us on Week in Review. We had Seattle Times transportation reporter David Krohman, host, writer, and producer Angela Poe Russell, KUOW labor and economy reporter Monica Nicholsberg. Week in Review is produced by Kevin Kniestad, social media and live streaming by Juan Pablo Chiquiza, Teo Popescu, and Bernard Wallet is running the board. Thank you for listening. I'm Mike Lewis in for Bill Radke.